The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right, welcome to a Wednesday. I'm Nicole Sandler here at NicoleSandler.com and on the Progressive Voices Network. Busy day. It's almost redundant that I come on and say that every day. It seems that every day is busy, but a lot has gone on this morning. What I thought today, we are 2 weeks. Tomorrow will be 2 weeks until the FCC votes on net neutrality. And I promised you we'd get into it. Back in the day when we were fighting, do you remember SOPA and PIPA and all those net neutrality related things that when Obama was president, we still had to fight to retain net neutrality and to get some protections in place. And we did. In 2015, there were some new regulations put in place to protect, well, my right to get online and do this show and your right to be able to click a link and watch or listen to it the same as you would anything else on the internet. Well, that is at risk. And it's at risk of a vote that's going to happen at the FCC 2 weeks from tomorrow. So coming up in the second half hour of the show, we'll speak with Tim Carr of freepress.net and savetheinternet.com about what's going on because it's sad. Yeah, that is. Pisces Bobby in the chat room just said, so sad. Keith will have no more comments. Keith Olbermann, who has been doing these special comments on for GQ online, said he's not going to anymore. He said Trump's presidency is over, basically, and he's not going to do these special comments any longer. He said he's retiring from all political discourse. We'll see how long that lasts. I wonder if that means he won't be tweeting anymore either. I would like to see him back on television because I'm old and I haven't completely migrated to YouTube. I still turn on that tube most nights. Salam Allah in the chat room is saying, what is the FCC doing with the internet? Seriously? Stay tuned and you'll hear because Tim Carr will be here in the second half hour of the show. Usually what I've done in this slot here is sort of bring you up to date on one or two news stories that have been going on, and then I go to my pre-recorded What's News segment. I thought today we'd try something different and try to do it live, to quote a now exiled former host on a cable news channel. Do it live. We'll do it live. I'm just going to try it because sometimes, you know, I struggle to get my What's News into 6 minutes, and sometimes there's more, sometimes there's less, and it's a stretch. But I thought today we would try something different and try to do What's News live. So
I read the news today, oh boy.
Let's see how it goes. Trump was on a Twitter rampage again this morning. In addition to going after NBC News over the Matt Lauer story, which we'll get to in just a couple of minutes, he retweeted an apparent snuff video and a couple of other anti-Muslim videos from a far-right Islamophobic British political activist by the name of Jada Franson. She's a member of a group called Britain First. The White House press secretary, Sarah Sanders, her response to these questions about Trump's anti-Muslim tweets, she said, whether it's a real video, the threat is real. His goal is to promote strong border security and strong national security. Oy. Okay. As for their part, a spokesperson for British Prime Minister Theresa May said, and this is a quote, "Britain First seeks to divide communities in their use of hateful narratives which peddle lies and stoke tensions. This causes anxiety to law-abiding people. British people overwhelmingly reject the prejudiced rhetoric of the far right, which is the antithesis of the values that this country represents, decency, tolerance, and respect. It is wrong for the president to have done this." So far, at least one of the videos has been deemed fake. Yeah, so there's that. Now, the story I alluded to earlier. Viewers of NBC's Today Show this morning learned that longtime host Matt Lauer was fired after the network said it received a complaint about inappropriate sexual behavior in the workplace. Co-host Savannah Guthrie read a statement from NBC News Chairman Andy Lack.
Just moments ago, NBC News Chairman Andy Lack sent the following note to our organization. Dear colleagues, on Monday night, we received a detailed complaint from a colleague about inappropriate sexual behavior in the workplace by Matt Lauer. It represented, after serious review, a clear violation of our company's standards. As a result, we have decided to terminate his employment. While it is the first complaint about his behavior in the over 20 years he has been at NBC News, we were also presented with reason to believe this may not have been an isolated incident. Our highest priority is to create a workplace environment where everyone feels safe and protected, and to ensure that any actions that run counter to our core values are met with consequences, no matter who the offender. We are deeply saddened by this turn of events, but we will face it together as a news organization and do it in as transparent a manner as we can. That is the statement from our chairman, Andy Lack, and we just learned this moments ago, just this morning. As I'm sure you can imagine, we are devastated, and we are still processing all of this. And I will tell you right now, we do not know more than what I just shared with you, but we will be covering this story as reporters, as journalists. I'm sure we will be learning more details in the hours and days to come, and we promise we will share that with you.
Mm-hmm. Matt Lauer was paid an estimated $25 million a year to co-host the Today Show. Just saying. Things aren't looking so good for John Conyers, as a group of Democrats, including members of the Congressional Black Caucus, are privately urging him to resign after a third former staffer went public with allegations of sexual harassment against him. Deanna Marr, who ran Conyers' Detroit field office from 1997 to 2007, told the Detroit News that Conyers made three unwanted sexual advances toward her, including instances of inappropriate touching. Garrison Keillor was also fired today by Minnesota Public Radio for allegations of inappropriate behavior. Just yesterday, he wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post defending Al Franken against calls for his resignation. And so it goes. North Korea fired an intercontinental ballistic missile for the first time in 2 months yesterday.
As you probably have heard, and some of you have reported, a missile was launched a little while ago from North Korea. I will only tell you that we will take care of it. We have General Mattis in the room with us, and we've had a long discussion on it. It is a situation that we will handle.
A little over 2.5 hours ago, North Korea launched an intercontinental ballistic missile. It went higher, frankly, than any previous shot they've taken. It's a research and development effort on their part to continue building ballistic missiles that could threaten everywhere in the world, basically. And in response, the South Koreans have fired some pinpoint missiles out into the water to make certain North Korea understands that they could be taken under fire by our ally. But the bottom line is it's a continued effort to build a threat, a ballistic missile threat that endangers world peace, regional peace, and certainly the United States.
That was Jim Mattis. Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi abruptly pulled out of a meeting yesterday with the president after he tweeted that they were weak on crime, wanted to substantially raise taxes, supported, quote, illegal immigrants flooding into our country unchecked, and that Trump didn't see a deal with them on taxes and federal spending. Schumer responded that it's time to stop tweeting and start leading, rebuffing Trump's invitation for what they called a show meeting, and instead asking for immediate talks with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Speaker Paul Ryan, which, of course, they refused. McConnell then lied and said he never, ever turned down a bipartisan meeting with President Obama. Again, that's complete and utter, what's the word? I think I have it here. Yeah.
Bullshit.
Yeah, that's what it is. Trump met with the Republican leaders instead, after which he was asked if he'll blame the Democrats if there's a government shutdown.
If that happens, I would absolutely blame the Democrats. If it happens, it's going to be over illegals pouring into the country, crime pouring into the country, no border wall, which everybody wants. I got elected partially because of a border wall. You look at the military, we want strong funding for the military. They don't. So many things. As an example, they want high taxes. We want cut taxes. We're going to cut taxes. We're going to reform. We're going to simplify. They want high taxes. We want low taxes. So there's. So we'll see what happens as to shutdown. We'll see. But right now, things have changed over the last 2 hours because 2 hours ago, a missile was launched. I think that will have a huge effect on Schumer and Pelosi. I think. We'll see. We're going to learn very soon. They should be calling immediately and say, we want to see you, but probably they won't because nothing to them is important other than raising taxes. That's the only thing they like doing is raising taxes. Thank you all very much.
This man just lies about everything. Anyway, Congress faces a December 8th deadline to pass stopgap legislation to keep the government open. Also faces other unfinished legislation, including hurricane relief, funding for children's health, and a lot more. Including their tax bill, yeah, which they moved out of the Senate Budget Committee yesterday by a party line vote of 12 to 11. Both Ron Johnson and Bob Corker, two whose votes were uncertain, both voted in favor of that legislation. Both voting in favor of the legislation. The bill now heads to the Senate floor, where it would likely be voted on before the end of the week. If it gets the necessary 50 votes, it moves to a conference committee where Republicans in the two chambers would have to reach an agreement on a consensus bill. A U.S. District Court judge yesterday rejected a lawsuit from Leandra English claiming that she and not the president's pick, Mick Mulvaney, is the rightful acting director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The ruling clears the way for Mulvaney to run the CFPB until a permanent director is sworn in or until English successfully appeals the decision. Trump last week appointed Mulvaney to lead the CFPB until the Senate confirms his pick to replace Richard Cordray, who resigned as director on Friday. Cordray appointed English, his deputy director, to be acting director. By the way, the judge who ruled yesterday, Judge Timothy Kelly, is a new Trump appointee who's only been on the bench for 2 months. The Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee is grilling Alex Azar today. He's the former Eli Lilly executive who was Trump's pick to replace the ousted Tom Price as Secretary of Health and Human Services. Today he's being grilled on why he thinks he should lead the massive federal agency that runs public health, drug oversight, medical research, and the government's major health insurance programs, which, by the way, includes the Affordable Care Act, which, despite what they're trying to tell you, is still sound and still loose, still in effect. And believe it or not, open enrollment is still going on through December 15th. You still have two more weeks to get your insurance through healthcare.gov or your state's exchange. That's a bit of what's news for now. I think if we go over to the phone, Luke Vargas is with us. He's the chief foreign correspondent for the Talk Media News Service at talkmedianews.com. Luke, are you there? Ah, I think that's not Luke. Hi, who's on the phone? Okay. Nobody's on the phone. I thought that was Luke Vargas calling in. Luke is supposed to be calling in. Hello? Nope. I guess we'll wait for Luke to call back in a moment. We'll take a very quick break and come back with Luke Vargas and the Talk Media News Service in just a moment.
We've had a great relationship, exalted a giddy Donald Trump following his two-day schmooze fest in Manila with the thuggish Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte. Duterte, who calls himself a toughie, brags that he's personally killed many people and likes to compare himself to Satan. He's been on a murderous rampage since his election last year. In the name of eliminating the drug trade, he's unleashed a massive military assault across the country, not merely targeting dealers, but also people using drugs. His onslaught is a human rights atrocity, with untold thousands essentially being executed in what are antiseptically termed extrajudicial killings, i.e., illegal, unjustified, murderous. Yet, the present president of the United States says Duterte is his new buddy, and Trump stressed in their official discussions that the Philippine president can count on him and the U.S., which includes you and me, to be a friend. And as a friend, Trump didn't bother his authoritarian buddy with any unpleasant talk about those rampant human rights abuses. Instead, the Duterte-Trump get-together was one of mutual praise and even affection. Indeed, Donald was delighted when Rodrigo impulsively grabbed the microphone at a gala state dinner and serenaded Trump with a love ballad, crooning, "You are the love I've been waiting for." In fact, Duterte had earlier demonstrated that love when he named Jose Antonio to be his trade representative to our country. Antonio, a Philippine real estate mogul, happens to be a partner with our president in the luxurious new Trump Tower, now under construction in Manila. Cozy, huh? This is Jim Hightower saying, hugging up the Manila Satan might be good business for Trump, but it's a sorry deal for our national interest, and it's an insult to our people's support of human rights.
Need an antidote to the progressive blues? Want some good news about how grassroots folks are rebelling against the corporate powers and winning? Well, here's an easy-to-swallow pill for you, the Hightower Lowdown. Hightower's monthly newsletter will give you the lowdown, even as it lifts you up. It's 4 pages a month, jam-packed with facts you can use, actions you can take, and Jim's own Texas humor, all for only $15 a year. To become a Lowdowner, go to HightowerLowdown.org.
All right, now for a look at what's happening. We could turn to our friends at the Talk Media News Service. They're at TalkMediaNews.com. And Luke Vargas, chief foreign correspondent, is with us today. Hey, Luke.
Hey, Nicole. It's been a while.
It's been a long time. Good to talk to you. So,
likewise.
Yeah. So what's going on? I know the UN Security Council is supposed to meet today to talk about yesterday's North Korean missile launch, huh?
Yeah, I don't know what I'm going to be able to write about this come this afternoon. They're going to meet at 4:30 p.m. And my guess is we don't really hear anything from this meeting beyond just sort of more stale rhetoric about the fact that the actions we're taking are going to eventually work. I just don't think there's any evidence of that. In fact, if you look at what North Korea's propaganda news channels have been saying today, they are really calling this sort of the ultimate victory, that they have finally gotten what they've wanted for so long, which is, you know, that the nuclear arsenal and the missile program are both sort of at the milestones that they've set out for years. And I don't think that's, you know, an exaggeration. I mean, we really are now seeing North Korean missile technology at levels that would have been previously unimaginable. So at this point, every time the president says, you know, major sanctions are coming, we're going to take care of it, just wait, we're handling the situation, I don't know what he's talking about, because North Korea has reached their sort of nuclear promised land, and no sanctions at this point are going to undo that.
Right. And what they're saying about this launch yesterday is that it went further than any of the other rockets so far, that this could have reached the East Coast, D.C. or New York. This is pretty scary stuff. And Trump is like, oh, we'll handle it.
Yeah. And the White House is also dusting off some old Chinese sanctions from the archive and repolishing them as if they're brand new political promises. In particular, I noted that some administration officials today were saying, look, China is banning tourists from going to North Korea. And that's actually quite significant. That's a something that will sort of sap North Korea of some tourist revenues and some prestige, because, you know, no one will be able to go to their ski resorts and water parks and things like that, which obviously have been paid for at the expense of feeding their own citizens. So that's a hit in prestige to the Kim regime. But that was actually announced when President Trump was in Asia, and is actually just sort of, they republished some articles in a Chinese paper today about how it's now going into effect. But this is should not be portrayed as China suddenly taking things even more seriously because of what happened yesterday. I think President Trump wants to make it seem like he can call up Xi Jinping in China and get them to increase pressure at a moment's notice. But that's not what we have any evidence of having occurred over the last 24 hours.
Right. Right. Although that you're right. That's the impression that the White House is trying to put out there. It's scary times we're living in, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I will say the launch itself, it went really high and then it came kind of straight down. It did go into the, I guess, up the east coast of Japan, actually pretty close to the Japanese mainland. And that's pretty important because it shows these North Korean missiles can re-enter the atmosphere without disintegrating into a million pieces. And that's something they had trouble with before. So that is actually quite impressive for them. On the other hand, it's not clear that so long as you can shoot something straight up really far, it means you can accurately aim it kind of sideways and send it all the way to an American target. That's not going to be a comforting thing for people to think about if they really are indeed of the belief that North Korea would want to test one of these missiles or actually shoot it at the United States, which I still don't think is the consensus view. But if you're, you know, afraid of their technology, I think yesterday's launch just, you know, makes you even more afraid.
Right. And it's not only it's being afraid of their technology, along with the guy who's sitting in the Oval Office.
It's a double whammy, huh?
It is. Sadly, it is. All right, Luke, what else is happening?
Really cool report from the RAND Corporation today. I don't often say that. I think you often have to take things coming out of that think tank with a grain of salt, especially considering they have been really pressed into service to do a lot of reports at the behest of the Trump administration that sort of play into the president's policy decisions. This one today, though, on the origin of American jihadists, which I'm putting that in quotation marks because I don't think they presented a terribly good methodology about why we should be including, you know, Muslim terrorists and not white supremacist extremists in this definition. But let's put that aside. What they found is that among these jihadists, that their quote in bold at the beginning of the report, American jihadists are made in the United States, not imported. And you go through this report, I mean, basically all these people are coming in or who are doing these attacks, these 22 attacks and 86 attempted attacks since 9/11. 155 of the 178, so I don't know what that is, close to 90%, if not over, were either born in the U.S., were naturalized U.S. citizens, or legal permanent residents. Only two were refugees. Only three were asylum seekers. They went on to say nationality is a poor predictor for whether someone is going to commit terroristic behavior. And this was the money quote, which completely sort of goes against the travel ban and things that the administration has been trying to put forward as a solution here. They said determining whether a teenager might, more than 12 years later, turn out to be a jihadist terrorist would require the bureaucratic equivalent of divine foresight. And so they're really throwing cold water on the notion that, you know, picking and choosing certain countries is going to do anything and, you know, poo-pooing the notion that any sort of algorithm or, you know, computer learning is going to be able to pick these people, you know, out of the haystack. That
right.
These people, you know, are coming from a lot of diverse backgrounds. And of the 10 countries, or 11 actually, of the most common countries of origin for people who are trying to commit these attacks in the United States, only one of them, Somalia, is on the president's travel ban. So we're entirely failing to capture the countries where these terrorists from abroad are coming in. So I think this is more, you know, I was wary of the title. I'm wary of the language used here. I think it's problematic, to say the least. But the actual the ways in which they sort of trash the Trump administration policies here, I think, is notable.
It is, because this doesn't give them much ammunition for their wall or the travel ban, for that matter.
No, it does commend American law enforcement and intelligence agencies for the sort of relative few number of attacks that have occurred. And they point out only 11 people are radicalized in the United States a year that fit this jihadist definition. Again, if you start to expand this to, you know, the person who committed the attacks in Charlottesville or some of these mass shootings, which certainly look like terrorism, I think your number's a lot bigger. But it does seem to dispel the sort of notion that some people feel this sort of apocalyptic sensation that all of the Muslims in the United States are radicalized. I mean, there's just this data does not suggest that at all. And they say there's no evidence of American jihadist groups emerging. There's no American intifada. There's no jihadist underground in the United States. Those are all impressions that I think you would actually believe if you just listen to the president's tweets and his own characterizations about this country. They said, look, that kind of homegrown risk is not happening. People get radicalized in isolated instances, but there's not like some grand mosque or gathering spot where a bunch of American jihadists are all hanging out, you know, in some no-go zone in an American right. city or something like
Boy,
that. So pretty fascinating report.
Definitely. All right. What else?
I'll say very briefly, we got a report out of this building, the United Nations, yesterday about medical products around the world. 1 in 10 in the developing world. This is medical products of all sorts of drugs, antibiotics, cancer treatments are either falsified or just completely don't work at all.
Oh,
and that's
my.
A really horrifying thing to think about in 2017 that we have, according to this report, millions and millions of doses of just completely, you could almost call them a placebo. I mean, there's just nothing in these drugs, and they're being sold and given to people who have life-threatening illnesses. And what's particularly scary about this is that the World Health Organization is basically saying this is getting worse, not better, that because of financial secrecy, you know, the kind of things we hear about in the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers, mm-hmm. the ability for a lot of wealthy financiers who sell drugs and things like that, that we can't follow the money of who's producing a lot of medicine, that the global supply chains of medical products makes it really difficult for regulators to see what's going on. And again, you know, it's sort of the bad coming along with the good, you know, sending more medicine out to, you know, remote parts of the world to try and address more and more diseases is just creating a bigger market for people who are, you know, trying to sell counterfeit medicines. But again, 1 in 10 pills or medical treatments people take in the developing world is not real. Means you've got hundreds of thousands of people dying because they're not getting treatment they need.
And these are drugs or devices manufactured here in the U.S.?
No, of all of drugs and devices made all over the world. And it specifically said that people get in low-income countries and middle-income countries. Ugh. So that is not, you know, stuff sounds like, and I don't think I'm speaking out of line here, this number is probably lower in the United States, but it is not good news for folks in Africa and in Latin America and in much of Asia who desperately need treatment and are being, you know, having fake products pawned off on them. And again, this is getting worse, not better, because of, you know, incomplete regulations and financial secrecy, which again, makes it very difficult to punish the people who are actually responsible for putting fake drugs on the market
wow.
when and if they're found. So not a good piece of news, especially as I understand from someone who, you know, needed medical treatment very recently. And, you know, you didn't, obviously outcomes are uncertain, but at least in the United States, you can count on the fact that, or hopefully count on the fact that the treatments that we receive are real.
Hopefully.
The fact that is not the case elsewhere is pretty scary.
It is. That's frightening. So Luke, in the next segment, we're actually doing a segment on net neutrality and what's happening here at the FCC. Apparently they're debating net neutrality in India now too.
Yeah, the Indian telecom regulator, which is called TRAI, came out, this might have been on Monday, but I wanted to feed this topic to you because it's top of mind for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this is the world's biggest democracy, essentially, India, which has put its foot down. Their regulator came out this week and said they're not going to allow any, quote unquote, discriminatory regulations that would slow down people's access to certain parts of the web or just wall off parts of the internet for users. In general, a pretty big statement. They said, you know, certain internet companies can employ reasonable traffic management practices. And if you have an expert guest on, I would be interested to hear what even folks who believe in net neutrality might consider reasonable. But they are going to be allowed to do some regulation of traffic on the internet, but they're going to have to be very public about what's happening, and they have to tell individual users how it affects them. You know, what I think they're trying to avoid is, you know, people finding, I'm really struggling to get on this, you know, news forum or something like that. And you're not aware of the fact that your own ISP is, you know, sending your speed down or trying to prevent you from going there. So I think this is it's not law, but it is sort of a draft regulation apparently in India. And it's certainly for net neutrality advocates, a sign of how, you know, the world, much of the rest of the world wants to take this issue, and it's a far cry from what the FCC is talking about.
Yeah, we seem to be moving in the wrong direction. A couple of weeks ago, there was a graphic going around the internet that had In Portugal, it shows in Portugal where they don't have net neutrality, they have sort of an a la carte menu of how you can buy different types of internet services to go on to your basic service and how expensive it gets.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We just learned today that Google's algorithm has changed for news, and they released some preliminary statistics about how traffic is changing, about the number of people getting referred to different news sites. And I saw that some sort of right-wing news, quote-unquote news websites, were getting hit pretty hard. But so was The Intercept, so was Democracy Now,
wow.
So were sort of websites that a lot of people on the political left enjoy. And you sort of pair that with this prospect of net neutrality, where like a major news organization might be able to pay an internet service company to make sure they're included on the basic package,
mm-hmm.
but that, you know, sort of independent media would likely not be able to pay that amount and might get, you know, put in the sort of the premium package or walled off from a lot of viewers, and the implications for the news environment start to sound pretty worrisome.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to get into that in just a few minutes. Luke Vargas, Chief Foreign Correspondent for the Talk Media News Service at talkmedianews.com. It's great to talk with you again, Luke. I look forward to
Likewise.
It again next
Take
time. Take care. Bye-bye.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Tim Carr is going to join us in just a few minutes from freepress.net and savetheinternet.com. So let's take a quick break and come back, and we'll start getting these net neutrality questions answered next.
These are the sounds of crushed souls, the sounds of despair from former radio personalities languishing in the purgatory of corporate consolidation. These former radio personalities have lost their livelihoods, not because they weren't entertaining or informative, but because they don't meet today's corporate terrestrial broadcast standards of being smelly, overweight douchebags, seething with vein-popping hatred. These radio refugees and their audiences have since migrated to the internet, but their struggle continues as the quest for monetization ensues. Nicole Sandler is leading the way to re-establishing thought-provoking and entertaining radio. And you can help by clicking the donate button on NicoleSandler.com. Donate today, or as much and as often as you can. Dry the tears of listeners by removing the rotting stench of corporate radio. Won't you help?
All right, I'm back. Nicole Sandler, back with you here at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network. Tim Carr used to come on the show quite a bit back in the Obama days when we were fighting for net neutrality, when we were fighting for some kind of regulation that would actually put some rules in place to say the internet is free and open and all speeds are the same. Anyway, Tim Carr is Senior Director of Strategy at freepress.net and savetheinternet.com. And since we're 2 weeks away from a vote in the FCC on the future of net neutrality, I couldn't think of anyone else I'd rather talk to. So, Tim Carr, you there?
Hi, Nicole.
Hey,
how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
It's been a very, very busy week. And, you know, the net neutrality victory that we won in 2015 is about to be ripped from our hands, which is really bad news.
So can you talk about what happened in 2015, what we actually got done with all of our activism and phone calls? And it was, you know, you would think we had a Democratic president. This should have been an easy one. It seems like everything we got done during the Obama years was a struggle. This was certainly a number of struggles. I remember fighting against SOPA and PIPA and fighting for net neutrality. We had a lot of things going on. What exactly did we win in 2015?
Well, Obama came out in support of net neutrality when he was a candidate in 2007. And it took us 8 years until 2015 actually to get workable net neutrality rules on the books. So, yes, that was a struggle, but it was one that in the end we won. We won in 2015 a ruling from the FCC that gave that agency the authority to prevent internet service providers. These are companies like AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon from blocking or throttling our connections. It also prevented them from what are called paid prioritization schemes,
mm-hmm.
where they give special access to websites and services that pay them extra money. So for example, Comcast would make its own services, its own streaming video services, perform much better than, say, a company like Netflix because it wants to prioritize traffic to its own sites. And so the rules that we got in place were really strong. They were also rooted in a strong part of the law, and what's called Title II of the Communications Act, which has withstood several legal challenges. And so that was considered one of the bigger public interest victories in the history of communications policy in the United States. And we rightly celebrated at that time. And, you know, millions of people were organized and wrote Congress and called the FCC. Mm-hmm. And we received a great victory. But Trump, you know, and you know, the Trump administration, if ever there is a Trump doctrine, it would be simply to undo everything that his predecessor Obama had accomplished. And one of the things Trump has determined, and he appointed to chair the FCC a person who shared this opinion, was that net neutrality needed to be destroyed. And so his appointee at the FCC, a fellow by the name of Ajit Pai, set about earlier this year to unwind this historic landmark victory. And we're coming up on a day, December 14th, next month, when this actual vote will go down, and we fully expect a Republican majority FCC to take away our rights to connect and communicate on the open internet.
Now, this is just the vote that's going to happen. It's just in the FCC. This is not – Congress doesn't have any control over this, huh?
The FCC is charged by Congress to interpret laws. And so they have some rulemaking authority around this issue. Now, there has been some talk in Congress about creating legislation, but unfortunately, we don't have – a great deal of confidence in seeing good net neutrality legislation out of this Congress. We'll likely have to wait for the next Congress in the expectation that the majorities in one of those houses might change. But so the FCC is acting on law that's already been passed by Congress, and that's pretty solid law that we believe it. You know, really establishes the authority for that agency to protect net neutrality. So we're going to, in all likelihood, lose this vote on December 14th, and Free Press plans to take the FCC to court to challenge this decision, establish that they haven't built it around a factual argument, or in addition, they've completely ignored the public in making this decision. There's been overwhelming support for net neutrality protections, not just from Democrats, but from Republican voters as well. So, So we have an FCC that's not only ignoring Democrats, which might be expected in a Trump administration, but also ignoring the Republican grassroots.
So what's going to happen is it's 2 weeks from tomorrow, I believe, the 14th is that right?
14th of December. I'm not looking at my calendar, but I know it's.
It's 2 weeks from. Yeah, it's 2 weeks from tomorrow.
2 weeks from Thursday. Yeah, they vote on Thursdays. Yeah, 2 weeks from Thursday.
So then, what can we expect? Are they all of a sudden? Are we going to see changes? Like something came to my attention today, an article at ARSTechnica.com. It says, Comcast deleted net neutrality pledge the same day FCC announced repeal. So they took off their website. The part where it has promises to uphold net neutrality, there was a thing, where they deleted a, quote, no paid prioritization pledge from its net neutrality webpage on the same day that they announced their plans to repeal these rules. So do we
AT&T has made a similar pledge. Comcast has made a similar pledge. I mean, all of these pledges are bogus. What these companies are trying to do. And initially, when the net neutrality debate started so many years ago, when you and I were talking about it, you know, the phone and cable companies said they were against net neutrality, that they thought it was a crazy idea. But then they saw the public outcry in support of the principle, so they decided then that they were for net neutrality. So they created all of this rhetoric on their websites and promotional campaigns that said, you know, we're for net neutrality, we just don't believe in rules that would allow the government to enforce it, which is sort of like saying you believe in free speech, you just don't agree with the First Amendment.
Right.
And so it's just kind of, it's ridiculous. And they're trying to put up this facade that says, you know, that basically says, trust us, we will not violate an open internet. Just get rid of these rules and leave it to the corporations to decide what's best. And that's just a bogus argument. And we, you know, anybody who's worked with these companies and knows how they routinely violate their own terms and services knows that we need a legal framework that can be enforced by the FCC and in a court of law to protect the open internet.
Earlier this week or last week, there's an LA Times article, but I think it started with a tweet from Ro Khanna, a congressman out of the San Jose area, who tweeted out a graphic of an internet service, a menu, as it were, from Portugal, where they do not have net neutrality. And you pay a certain amount for your basic, I guess, internet connection. And then depending what you want to do with the internet, messaging, social, video, music, email and cloud, all of those are separate charges that then go put on top of your basic cost for internet. This is going to get, could get very complicated and very expensive, can it, going forward for
someone?
Well,
essentially they're looking at like a cable TV mm-hmm. business model where they decide what you get and how much you pay for it, and the cable TV model is like you could buy the premium, you could buy the standard package, which will get you the ability to surf websites and send email. But if you want to stream video and use YouTube or Netflix, you have to pay this much more. And if you want to use social media like Facebook, you have to pay this much more. And
wow.
So there have been a lot of those kinds of scenarios that have been passed around the internet. And if the net neutrality rules are done away with, which we fully expect them to do on December 14th, those scenarios are possible. There is nothing in the law that would prevent ISPs from doing that. So that is a very real reality. And what this essentially is about who controls the future of communications. The thing that has been so revolutionary, truly revolutionary about the internet, is that it puts that control in the hands of internet users. The network was created so that all of the power exists on the edges. We get to decide what services we use, where we go, and what we do on the internet, and there's no gatekeeper in the middle that tells us what news sites we have to go to or what streaming video services we have to use. And that's been the beauty of the internet. It's what's made it such a revolutionary medium that has allowed even the smallest voices out there to find an audience. And they're trying to change that in order to take control of the future communications and in order for them to change that. And when I say they, I'm talking about these very large ISPs. In order for them to do that, they have to undo these net neutrality protections. So this is really about how these companies that provide access to the internet take control of the content that flows across that network.
Right. Content similar like my show, for instance, which goes out over YouTube, and it also goes out over my own audio stream. So they could get me coming and going. They could demand more money from me to be able to stream out from here, and from my listeners, if they want to be able to watch the show on YouTube or listen to the audio stream, they could have to pay more in terms of fees. Is that correct?
This is potentially very harmful to small independent production outfits like yours, because they could prioritize. Comcast is a perfect example. Comcast could prioritize the services that it offers. Comcast just so happened to have purchased NBC Universal back mm-hmm. in 2011, which means they have a vested interest in prioritizing NBC News, MSNBC, CNBC, all of the properties that they own, and in creating fast lanes for them while relegating other independent outlets to a smaller, slower lane of the internet.
That's pretty frightening. And so, but this is sort of the Wild West, right? Because we have no idea how this is going to happen. Any thoughts on how they're going to roll this out? I mean, who would be first at the gate?
Well, I'll tell you what, past this prologue, because we have a long history of net neutrality violations. For example, Comcast, again, we can use Comcast as an example. Comcast blocked file sharing services. So there are a lot of file sharing services out there where people were, you know, sharing music and video files, some of them illegally, but not all of them. There were ones that were legitimately sharing rich media files, and they blocked all of that. And so there's a long history of violations, not just by Comcast, but by Verizon, AT&T, and others. So it's entirely likely, and it's entirely in their interest, that they will start doing these sorts of things going forward. They will start to prioritize websites and services that they like, and your internet experience will become even more controlled by these sorts of gatekeepers. So there are some very real concerns, but essentially what we're trying to do here is preserve the architecture of this open network so that a lot of the innovation and a lot of the elevation of new political voices that we've seen online has a future.
Tomorrow there are going to be protests at Verizon stores all around the country. Are you guys involved with that?
That's planned for December 7th.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's December 7th. It's a week from tomorrow.
Yeah, on December 7th, there are going to be protests at Verizon stores around the country. Yes, Free Press is involved with that. We, through our coalition website, battleforthenet.com, are organizing protests. And we've asked people to sign up to, you know, show up in front of their own their local Verizon store and have a process, and thus far we have more than 500 locations that people have signed up for. So we're in the process right now of verifying all those locations and making sure that people turn out. So if people are interested in doing that, they can learn more about that at battleforthenet.com.
Okay, battleforthenet.com. Tim Carr is with us from freepress.net, savetheinternet.com. You've been working on this for a long time. And so
yes, I have.
And
I started in 2005.
Wow. Wow. I know. We've been talking about it almost that long, I think. Now here we are, the 14th. Now, there's all kinds of campaigns to call your congressman. But again, as you just mentioned, this Congress isn't going to do anything. So this, I mean, it's good to get out and protest and make our voices heard. We all called the FCC. I mean, John Oliver on last week tonight of a few months back did a thing talking about net neutrality and crashed the FCC's comment website. That didn't even do any good. Why should we bother doing this now?
Well, we need to demonstrate repeatedly that there is overwhelming public consensus of support for net neutrality protections. Even if this FCC is determined to ignore the public and put in place bad rules, this decision on December 14th isn't the end of the story. We plan to take them to court. And one of the things that we want to demonstrate in our legal case is that this FCC blatantly ignored the public. The process that they put in place for this rule change is called a notice of proposed rulemaking, in which they open their docket to public comment. And millions of people have commented since they did that this year. And they are ignoring those people. We also need to continue to speak out to demonstrate to all of our members of Congress that there is a strong base of support for net neutrality across the country. And it doesn't matter what part of the political spectrum you sit on, both left and right. In poll after poll, it shows that support net neutrality. So should this issue go from the FCC to Congress, where they might try to write new legislation, all members of Congress need to know where the public stands on this issue. So December 14th is going to be a dark day for our lovers of the open internet, but it's not going to be the end of the story.
Okay, so the fight's going to continue. There's other things that this FCC has done. In fact, right before they put out their plans to gut net neutrality, they also changed the cross-ownership rules. to where, yeah. You know, I remember when I first got into radio, I'm one of those people, I studied broadcasting in college. This is what I've been doing for my entire adult life. And I remember back in those days, one company could own one AM, one FM, one TV in a market. Now, obviously, those limits are off, and they've also thrown newspapers in the mix. So one voice could own all kinds of all the media in a market. And this is something that they've just it's sort of a new wave of media consolidation going on, isn't it?
That's right. This same FCC under Ajit Pai is not only working to take away our right to an open internet, they're also changing the media ownership rules that are enforced at the FCC. The FCC's central mandate, the whole reason the agency was set up many, many years ago, was to protect diversity, competition, and localism over the public airwaves. And this FCC is going in the opposite direction. It has changed a number of media ownership limits that would allow a television company like Sinclair, which has a demonstrated history of right-wing broadcasting, to control television stations that cover 72% of the U.S. population. There are limits that are supposed to that are in place that are supposed to keep that that reach to 39% of the U.S.
Wow.
population for any one broadcast company, and they've blown past that. And this FCC fully intends to make, you know, to unleash yet another wave of media consolidation, not only, you know, as we're seeing with like Comcast in the internet space, but also in the traditional broadcast radio and newspaper space.
I know there was a plan to get universal broadband across America. Has that been rolled back under the Trump administration as well?
Well, there's a goal to get everyone online by 2020. That I believe is still in place. The different administrations have different ideas as to how you accomplish that. Under the Obama administration, you saw funding, public funding for communities that wanted to build out their broadband networks and support for what are called community broadband networks,
mm-hmm.
where a city or a municipality builds its own network in order to reach more people. Under the Trump administration, that's changed. Their idea is that to gain universal access, you just give tax incentives to companies like AT&T and Comcast, with the thought that they'll use that surplus to expand their networks. So, you know, they are playing lip service to this idea of universal broadband, but that goal in the hands of Ajit Pai, it simply translates to giving more tax incentives, basically more money to very established phone and cable companies, and not trying to encourage communities to build their own broadband networks through, you know, through legal protections and public financial support.
I wonder, you know, how do they justify the idea of killing off net neutrality? You know, making it. How do they sell it to the world?
To be frank,
yeah,
they justify it by lying through their teeth. They call net neutrality heavy-handed government regulation of the internet. That's false. It is not a regulation of the internet. It is a regulation of internet service providers, a regulation of companies. And these companies like AT&T and Comcast, no more represent the internet than, say, a company like Georgia Pacific represents the forests. I mean, they have justified it, one, by just blatantly lying. They've also relied upon bogus data. There's an industry in Washington where the phone and cable companies fund think tanks. They fund research to generate data that would suggest that somehow net neutrality is bad for business, it's bad
Amazing.
For investment. And so Chairman Ajit Pai's case against net neutrality is entirely built on this mountain of false evidence. And so that's one of the reasons that we'll be bringing them to court. We want to challenge the factual basis. We want to challenge the legal basis. We also want to demonstrate that there is no justification for changing these rules. And that the public overwhelmingly opposes it.
Now, back to broadcasting for a moment, Tim. You mentioned Sinclair. Has the Sinclair sale, a takeover of all the Tribune stations, has that been approved yet?
It has not yet been approved, but the FCC is working as hard as possible to remove any obstacles to that deal. Now, you may recall that Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was bragging about a deal that he had struck with Sinclair during the campaign, in which Sinclair would give Trump favorable coverage over its network of 100 local television stations. So, you know, it's reasonable to expect that this deal will go through. It's also reasonable to expect that this was quid pro quo. It was an exchange of favors, whereby the Trump administration would remove regulatory obstacles to a bigger and larger Sinclair if it is successful in gaining all those Tribune stations. It will have more than 223 stations across the country. And in exchange for, you know, removing those regulatory obstacles, the expectation is that Sinclair will give the Trump administration very favorable coverage over its local networks. And one of the things that Sinclair does is it creates these must-run commentaries where they have a former Trump administration official doing 2 to 3 minute commentaries that are then farmed out to all of the Sinclair local stations with the mandate that they must run them during their nightly newscasts. So you'll already see that this kind of Trump propaganda is already in place, and it's just now up to Chairman Pai to return the favor by kicking away these obstacles.
That is so frightening. And that the thing that makes this so much worse than, say, Fox is one channel. It's a channel, and people get it on their cable system. The Sinclair stations are all local TV stations, and not only do they have the prepackaged, pre-recorded, you know, 2 to 3 minute pieces, they also have scripts that they give them that one of their anchors has to read. Also must run content. So it seems like it's coming from your local TV station, which I guess for some reason some people put more credence in than a network like Fox.
I mean, according to Pew, which does a lot of research on media, people list local television, local radio, and local newspapers as one of their top political influencers.
Wow.
And that's the reason why that during campaign years, during midterm and general election years, there's so much money spent on political advertising via local television stations, because they know that's a very influential medium. So now you're not only going to see political advertising during the breaks, but if you're watching a Sinclair station, you'll also see political advertising, or a more appropriate term, propaganda, during the commentary sections of the news, and even in some of the news stories that are provided as, you know, objective coverage.
Wasn't there a law against propaganda?
There is a law against propaganda, but it's propaganda. It's propaganda. There is a law against propaganda. The law against propaganda was that, you know, you couldn't spread propaganda through domestic networks. It didn't. You know, we have propaganda networks that, on a global scale, back in the Cold War days when Radio Voice of America was beaming its message into Soviet Russia,
right,
and communist China, you know, that was propaganda that served, you know, the State Department's interests. But now, you know, we have propaganda domestically. I am not sure how that law would apply to what Sinclair is doing. And they would probably make a pretty sound First Amendment argument that they're just expressing their own opinions and that they're taking no directives from government, but you know, it's an interesting discussion to have.
Yeah, well, it's a good time to have freepress.net on our side. It's scary time in this country, though. Battleforthenet.com has all the information on what you can do to fight this move to undo net neutrality that is set to happen. There are protests happening December 7th, a week from tomorrow, and the FCC will be voting on December 14th. Tim Carr, thank you for all your hard work, and thanks once again for coming on and explaining it all to us.
My pleasure, Nicole.
It's great talking with you. Thanks again.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Tim Carr. Again, he is the, what is his official title? He is the Senior Director of Strategy at FreePress.net and SaveTheInternet.com. And, of course, the other website he gave out was BattleForTheNet.com. That's a coalition of a lot of groups who are working together. As he said, you know, this is going to happen on the 14th, but we still need to raise our voices and show that, you know, that we're fighting back. At least we got to fight back. We can't just roll over and let them take advantage of us. All right? Okay. I don't know. I honestly don't know the future of this program. I guess we wait and see what happens. But we keep fighting. It's all we can do. Tomorrow, Howie Klein's back. It's Thursday. In the meantime, thank you for listening. I'm Nicole Sandler for NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.